Commissioner, you can start when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good to be back with you again today. We were discussing the nursing facility level of care thresholds, and we left off on page 60, for my notes at least. We had just completed talking about the essential community service grant funding that we are recommending, and we're about to move into the assessment portion of this proposal. And let me begin by saying that both for this program as well as the PCA program, it really starts with a good assessment, trying to determine what an individual's needs are, as well as what the informal supports are that an individual has in their community, friends, families, neighbors, etc. So we are trying to implement what we refer to as COMPASS, or a comprehensive assessment. We've been working on this for several years, building it that so that it would apply to all of the long-term care population, as well as be more efficient in its administration. It does require a substantial amount of training in the administration of the tool, and part of this proposal addresses that. We would like to train and certify the assessors who will be doing this work. These are typically public health nurses and or social workers who are interacting with the program participants to complete the assessment. Additionally, we know that there will be ongoing needs for training because we are recommending that the assessors be recertified every 3 years to demonstrate their continued competence. It will be web-based so that we use the newest of technologies in order to share information and link that to other portions of a person's life and the system. It really is critical for us to have this new tool for all of our long-term care programs, and the value is in future years we will have a database on individuals and their needs across all populations, and we'll be able to determine how well the system is meeting those needs. So there's a current need and then the future opportunities with this tool.
So, Mr. Coleman, you're, I mean, this item happens to be the modifying the level of care.
Yes.
For that, that's for a particular group that's eligible for NA, may or may not go to a nursing home, and this assessment's going to be done on them, but you're talking about a broader picture now, where you're looking at the assessments of the needs of everybody in the system.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is a tool that would apply to all individuals in the long-term care system. It would include those who are trying to determine nursing facility level of care, but it would apply also to those individuals who are looking at the use of personal care attendants, for example. It also replaces several tools that are currently in existence that kind of grew up at different times. The long-term care assessment, the development of disability assessment, mental health assessments. It collapses all of those tools into this single tool that has been built in modules so that you don't have to do the whole assessment if the needs of the individuals don't indicate a need for those distinct parts.
Is this who determines when somebody's in a nursing home what care level they can get reimbursed for? Is that part of this assessment?
Mr. Chair, that's a different assessment. That is the minimum data set, or the MDS, known in the industry. and that is what is used upon admission to a nursing home, and then periodically thereafter it's updated to determine the RUGS category or the classification that the facility would get paid.
And who does that?
That is done, Mr. Chair, that is done by the facility staff.
Oh.
And then it's submitted to the Department of Health, and they can, and they verify that, they monitor whether those assessments are being accurately completed, and then it's transmitted to us for payment based upon that category.
Go ahead.
So this comprehensive assessment not only applies to the nursing facility thresholds, but it applies to all of our long-term care program participants. And I think any questions on this portion of the proposal?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. And you know, this is probably a too simple question, but is it possible that someday the assessment that you're talking about moving to could replace the assessment that happens when someone's admitted? I mean, are they alike?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, not likely, because the MDS assessment is a federal requirement. It's used for Medicare as well as setting our Medicaid rates. And MDS is really very, I guess I would characterize it as clinically oriented. It looks at more healthcare needs and the abilities of an individual regarding that than the broader scope of what supports the person needs to, you know, as a whole. But we really don't have an option of whether facilities will utilize the MDS, because that's federally mandated.
Yeah, we'll interrupt for a minute. We do have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting officially to order. And do we have minutes? Somebody wish to move the minutes? Representative Thiessen moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And we're officially in the meeting. Mr. or Commissioner Coleman, you can continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll move on to page 63, which is our PCA redesign proposal.
Can I just back on that last one? I'm sorry, I got here late. Do we know how much of the how many people of the 1,100 to 8 million will pick up? All of them,
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we would intend to be able to provide services to all of them.
Okay, thank you.
And Commissioner Coleman, what's the cost of developing this new assessment system? How long will it take?
Mr. Chair, the development of the system has already been, I won't say 100% completed, but it's completed to the extent that we're able to move to the implementation stage. We've piloted the assessment tool in 11 counties around the state, received feedback, we're making adjustments to the tool, the questions, formatting, etc. The implementation of the tool is in this budget activity, and it will require a substantial amount of training for, again, the public health nurses, social workers, etc., and not just one-time training, but additional ongoing training. And let me find my notes. It's around $2.5 million in the. Bear with me. Mr. Chair, it's $2.7 million in the first year, $3 million in the second year, and then it drops down to $700,000 in the third and the fourth years of implementation.
And Commissioner, do we pay for the hours that the public health nurses are going to put in that, or is the county responsible for that?
Mr. Chair, we have not included compensation for that in our budget activity.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. I hope I don't take too long. First, with the modification of these thresholds, we've been talking about trying to keep nursing facilities held harmless or minimize their cuts. Will this ultimately reduce anticipated level of funding for our nursing facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, this will not reduce any rate to facilities. It does not require anybody currently in a facility to move. It will have impact longer term because it will divert people to other settings who would no longer qualify for a nursing facility level of care. So it does have impact longer term.
Representative Haas. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question on the waivered services portion and thresholds on that end. Have you built into your calculations, I mean, from my understanding, individuals that are eligible for MA have a right to institutional care. It's an entitlement to institutional care. If we cut the thresholds when it comes to home and community-based services through the waiver program, are you then also adding a increased demand on skilled nursing facilities for their entitlement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, the entitlement is the nursing facility stay. As an alternative to the nursing facility stay, the waiver may be available to people, but the waiver in itself is not an entitlement. We can manage the number of people who are able to access the waiver. Don't know if I directly answered your question yet.
Representative Hodge. One more time, Mr. Chair. I mean, just from when you, in your budget documents, your relationship to the base budget, it says clearly that there's reductions in elderly and disabled care waivers and home care grants. Because of those reductions, are you going to then have a greater demand or a higher increase in institutional care needs? Have you factored that into your forecast?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, we look at the system as a whole and try to assess the impacts of the various settings where people may be receiving services. If I follow your thinking, it's unlikely by raising the threshold for nursing facility level of care that would result in more people being placed in institutions.
But Mr. Coleman, if we're raising the threshold to be eligible for the waiver, one also has to be eligible to be in the institutional setting.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So if we raise that threshold, then we should reduce people going into nursing homes as well as reduce people going into waivers.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Representative Eason.
Okay, just to follow up on that. So there's a Medicaid entitlement, which is a federal entitlement, but we can set the standard at which that entitlement can be accessed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eason, that's my understanding, yeah.
Okay. And we're above it right now, presumably. And we're not going to run afoul of the feds by doing something like this.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not anticipate a problem with the federal government.
Please continue, please.
Okay. PCA.
Let me just interrupt for one thing. for the members, is a really big deal, this section, as well, because, first of all, the savings, but then it represents a fairly significant change in policy. And the next issue is also one that we've heard from the legislative auditor on, and is an area that we really ought to look at seriously to try to change some of the things that happened there. So with that lead-in, Commissioner, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, we agree. This is an important section, and we think we've done a fair amount of homework and a fair amount of thinking about how to redesign this program to target it to those people who can most appropriately be served in this program. Certainly, the OLA evaluation has been important as we've looked at this redesign, but it's not the only input that we have used in order to make some recommendations. An additional comment is this is an important program, and I don't think we'll ever be finished with taking a look at this program and making sure that it is meeting the needs of the people who have access to this program. It's almost a continuous work in progress. We're going to make these recommendations to change the program, and then we need to evaluate how those changes have played out for the consumers and the providers of these services, and likely we'll be back in a couple of years and in 4 years and whenever to make some adjustments. But we do believe that the program has grown faster than we've been able to manage it, and that we need to make some important changes to it. We want to change the access to PCA services. We want a different definition of who would have access to the personal care attendant program. The document that we began reviewing yesterday on level of care and the assessment process, the lavender sheet, will address how we propose to modify the PCA program. With the PCA program, we are recommending that an individual have a need in at least two activities of daily living, and those could include queuing and constant supervision, or hands-on assistance, or assistance that's needed daily. And so we're better defining the definitions of these components. This criteria has not been as clearly defined as what we are suggesting here. And then the COMPASS tool that we referenced earlier would be used, again, to assess people who are applying to this program. An important change element is currently the process for the public health nurse is to complete the assessment and then determine the number of minutes each task that an individual needs to complete would be authorized. So they have to go through a very detailed assessment and determine in minutes, in units, how many hours to authorize for this program. We're proposing to simplify that and use the COMPASS tool to determine one of 10 home care ratings. And each home care rating would have a base number of hours that would be the maximum authorized for that individual. Doesn't mean they have to use that number of hours, but that would be the maximum authorized. And then, based upon the individual's needs, they may get additional hours allocated on page 64, right in the middle. They can get an additional 30 additional minutes for each critical ADL, 30 additional minutes daily for complex health-related needs, an additional 30 minutes for a behavioral issue as defined in this proposal, so cognitive impairment or other mental health needs.
Representative Murphy, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coleman, I'm looking at the lavender sheet and the buttons that you have for the ADLs, and just trying to understand the difference between the queuing and constant supervision to begin or the hands-on assistance and assistance is needed daily. Those seem, they all seem like they're assistance that would be needed daily. Can you help me understand that, or can you help me, can you unpack that a little more for me, please?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. The first elements here have to be met in order to have access to the program. Once that has been determined, additional time on an individualized basis will be allocated based upon these additional components. So it's kind of a building block decision process, but you have to meet the basic needs first. There are some ADLs, which we've labeled critical ADLs, that are less controlled, less predictive. They don't manage to a clock. If somebody needs to be positioned, that's on an as-needed basis and does require more time for someone to be there to assist in that activity. So we're trying to distinguish basic needs with those that are more specific to an individual.
Representative Murphy.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coleman. That makes complete sense to me. I'm just trying to understand, and maybe I'm just, you know, on too many decongestants, but the and under line number two, you know, you've got the first bullet, the second bullet, and then the indented that this queuing and constant supervision or hands-on assistance and assistance is needed daily. I'm just trying to understand how those fit together. If those represent building blocks, or if those are menu items, you have to have one of those.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, they're more menu items. You know, as we've worked through how to better define the assessment process and make sure that people are getting the right number of allowable hours, as we've worked through trying to define who should be served in this program, there was no single solution that we could find that would incorporate those that we think could best be served in this program. So, for example, I don't think we're giving away any trade secrets. We started with hands-on assistance, that somebody physically had to provide assistance to an individual. Well, that left some people out that we considered important to access this program, so we went to queuing and constant supervision to complete an ADL. So they're not mutually exclusive, but you can meet either one of those in order to have access to the program. Okay, so the authorization of time is really a key component. It is the subject of substantial variation, dispute, negotiation. We're trying to simplify that and just say, here's the number of hours based upon the needs of the individual, and I think it will benefit the consumers, it'll benefit the people doing the assessment, it'll be clearer for people to understand what they have to work with in hiring and managing personal care attendant services.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two questions. One's a practical one, and partly not so we don't spend that much time. We're going to have to move this through, presumably this piece, at least in terms of those, through a couple of different committees. When are we going to actually have language for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I don't have a date. It's being worked on currently.
Okay.
It's likely to be another couple of weeks.
Okay.
This is complex.
The sooner the better, obviously. And, you know, even if it's not completely worked out, it would help us to kind of start digging into it. Second question is, so you add hours for transferring, toileting, those kind of things, and you're adding hours because you don't know when things are going to happen. So are you going to add a lot of hours for that kind of stuff? I mean, if the idea is that you need someone there and you're not sure when you're going to need someone there, does that mean someone's going to be there all the time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, on page 64, we have defined for each critical ADL, you could get additional 30 minutes. So there will be, there is a finite number of minutes that someone would be able to hire a PCA and be paid.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. I have two questions. In our small groups, you talked about some of this is going to phase in over time. What phase in time do you expect for this compass and to have this all implemented with this new plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. We would anticipate initiating this program January 1, but to accommodate the assessments that are going to be needed to be completed on these individuals, we anticipate a 6-month phase-in so that the assessors would be able to complete that task.
And I think that, I mean, this is just going to be a difficult assessment, but I think this kind of guidance is going to help make the system have better integrity, and then we can decide where we're helping and not helping. The people who are going to fall off of this system, what kind of individual would that be? What, they're going to come to us and say we're out, and so what are we going to, who are we going to hear from about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we anticipate that there'll be a little over 2,000 people who would no longer have access to this program. The description of the individuals are varied. There are some people with a physical disability that would not have access. There are some people with mental health needs. There are some developmental disability individuals who would not have access to this program. Not solely based upon the new criteria. There are a couple other features that I would want to point out that we are recommending changing. Under the consumer health and safety component, bullet point Roman numeral 4, we are recommending some additional quality assurance measures. We currently have a difficult time reconciling the use of personal care attendants in housing with services. We are recommending that where a housing with service purchase is being made, or some of those would be better known as assisted living, where a bundled service is being purchased by the consumer, we would not allow a personal care attendant to replace that bundled package that's already being paid for. That's more likely to be occurring in an elderly waiver kind of situation. So we're restricting the use of personal care attendants. We're not eliminating, but we are restricting where bundled service is already being purchased in that fashion. Additionally, we are recommending that either an individual be able to direct their own care, which is the origin of the program for those individuals who wanted more control over their caregiving, that an individual be able to direct their own care, or that they are living with their responsible party if they are not able to direct their own care. That is not currently a requirement. And we think separating the responsible party living arrangement with the individual who can't direct their own care is not a good practice. And so we are recommending returning to that requirement to access the program. We're also recommending that supervision be required, not optional. Right now it's optional from a qualified professional. We want better oversight, and we want to require that that supervision take place routinely. Those are some of the components that are all impacting whether somebody would have access to this program.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at all these definitions. Did you include any discussion about the use of technology or all the new technologies that might be supplementing some of this kind of care that's more cost effective in the long run and might be used as a supplement or even take the place of some of the services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, we have some grant dollars that we're recommending that we use to allocate to counties to really have a more disciplined approach to evaluating the use of technology in meeting people's needs. We can bear with me. Where do we have it? Okay. I know it's here, I just have to be directed to it.
Well, Commissioner Coleman, I'm happy to know that I'm not the only one that sometimes gets confused in this area.
I'm with you. We'll get to that when we get to the waiver limits, where we're recommending waiver limits, because there is a considerable amount of interest in technology, and we see that there is value in looking at technology. We haven't had a comprehensive way of really evaluating how technology can support people and how that can actually replace staffing in various settings. So I'll try to remember to highlight that when we get to the waiver enrollment limits.
And the disability associations have a proposal that they'll be releasing shortly that relates to the technology.
The
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Coleman. In perusing these pages, what I see missing, if my understanding is correct of the history of this program and its current practice, is in some instances we have family members, mothers of adult children, grandmothers of down children, et cetera, who are serving as the PCAs for their relatives. I know in terms of some of the discussions over the last many months, weeks about PCAs and what changes might be made in terms of issues of maybe fraud or misuse or too many hours, things like that. Issue of the family relation has been mentioned, but unless I missed it in skimming here so quickly, I don't see it explicitly addressed in any way. So that's my first question is, are we making any policy changes regarding use of family members of CCAs? And then the second question has to do with your new system and the HCR. What is the total number of hours that might be possible in a week to have a CCA under the new system as opposed to what might have occurred on the old system? And that might vary across different categories and individuals. So if you could give me some examples of what the maximum amount of hours might be if one fully maxed out the new system. I appreciate that.
All right. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, we are not recommending any changes to families being eligible beyond the current definition or the current restrictions. It was an area that the OLA looked at, and they did not see any recommended policy changes in that area. So you're not missing it. It's not there. Additionally, the number of hours that would be maxed out, so to speak, currently is about 14 hours maximum per day. Under this proposal, maximum would be 12 and a half. Mm-hmm. So we are reducing the maximum number of hours if you met all of the conditions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Continue.
Okay, the last portion of this important reform is the implementation of provider standards, Roman numeral 4. We have had a substantial growth in the business activity of providing personal care assistance, we are better defining what the obligations of that business is to conduct PCA services in Minnesota. All PCA agencies would have to provide this documentation upon initial enrollment as a provider and then annually thereafter. For example, Fidelity and Surety Bonds, criminal background checks for agency staff. Requiring a written agreement between the agency and the consumer as to what they can expect, the conditions and terms, what they would be committing to providing to that consumer, so that we have a written documentation for when it's not working the way it is understood to be working, we have something concrete to be working with. Required training. Right now, trainings are optional. We are recommending that agency staff and personal care attendants themselves go through required training in order to perform those functions in Minnesota. We are also recommending that we limit the number of hours a personal care attendant can work on a monthly basis. And in our proposal, that limit is at 310 hours per month. We believe that with better definitions, required training, annual re-enrollment for the agencies, that it will provide a better discipline to the business practices of these organizations, and that we will be able to better monitor whether they're performing in accordance with our expectations. A key component of the reform.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. I have three questions about this section, and maybe you can just, I'll answer them all, you can just answer them in bulk. Have you booked the cost for training into your proposal? Is this kind of a licensing thing or just a registration? And how on earth can one person work 310 hours and still live?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler.
Representative Abler, I thought you were used to that.
First of all, we are not recommending licensing. This would be provider enrollment. In order to be eligible to be a provider in our programs, they would have to meet this criteria initially and then annually thereafter. Licensing, quite frankly, has been considered previously at the state level. The cost of that, in the past at least, has been considered to be higher than we're willing to pay. So we're inching towards there, but we're not calling for licensure. The 310 hours is a challenging number, but a number that, again, weighing a number of factors that went into that calculation. First of all, these are not high-paying jobs. And individuals who are trying to pay their bills in today's economy are likely to be either working this or working two or more jobs in order to have a sufficient income. So this puts a limit on it, but it doesn't make it so that the consumer, the personal, the individual recipient has to, by default, use multiple personal care attendants. Familiarization with your personal care attendant is a highly valued feature of this program, and so their needs are not going to change, and if they have to have different people coming at different hours and on different days, that diminishes their quality of life.
Representative Abler,
thank you. I just thought of one other thing. I appreciate that. I mean, if some of us work more than that every month, but I do. Anyway, the on the talking to some people, that the state pays a certain price, I think, for a PCA, which is a number of $16 or something. Are you going to ask these registrants, or whatever you're going to call them, to report what they pay their staff so we can get some idea about the overhead that they're extracting, and so people will know that there's a, it's helped get a market? Right? Yeah. And has that been considered at all, so more money would go to the PCAs and hopefully to help them become better PCAs and draw more careers into it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, requiring reporting of compensation is not part of this set of recommendations. We certainly share an interest that the personal care attendant be paid as much of the rate that we're paying as possible, but we are leaving that to the agency and the employee to determine that that arrangement for the PCPOs.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in here that is going to increase, I guess the 310 hours kind of gets there, but it's going to increase the way that people report? And it seems like with technology there'd be better ways for PCAs on the road to just report in to the department about when they get to a certain place and when they get back from a certain place by telephone or what have you, to have kind of an audit check on that. Have you guys thought about anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we're aware of technology that is available. It's an investment that would need to be made, and it wasn't it didn't land on our priorities for reform at this point in time. But we are aware, and we have looked at some models of that.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that another part of DHS has already purchased technology that kind of does that. And so hopefully we can have more conversations about that. You already have the license to do that. The other question I had was just on the training. Do we know if it's effective? And if we're going to invest all this money in it, have we done any analysis to see if training actually improves the quality? You know, because I'm got to go through CLEs as a lawyer. Really doesn't make much, you know, doesn't help that much. And I just want to... so get a sense of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I'm not familiar with the research on that, but we'll get you an answer if there is some research that demonstrates the effectiveness of this specific training.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Emmer, do you have a comment on that? Commissioner, go ahead.
All right, moving on, if we can, to page 67, federal compliance for home and community-based waivers. As you're all aware, the federal government is our partner in these programs. They pay for half or 50 cents on the dollar, at least today. Therefore, we have some ways that we need to satisfy CMS. We've had waivers in these home community-based programs for many years. Each time the waiver is authorized for a limited amount of time, typically 5 years. Every time they are renewed, a new set of questions, a new set of expectations are delivered to Minnesota from CMS. An area that they have zeroed in on in the last year or two is how we manage the state-county relationship. And currently, the counties are able to negotiate contracts with providers in the waivers and then set the rates. CMS has determined that is a layer of activity that does not produce the results that they want to see. Therefore, even though, as you can see, we need additional money to do this, we are proposing that we change the methodologies that are currently in place. We, as a state, through our provider enrollment, would develop a contract with providers. We would manage those contracts. We would make them available through technology to counties, so they still could select which providers they're going to access in their communities, but they wouldn't do the actual management of a contract. So you could put this in the heading of relieving counties of some activity. Additionally, the second component that we need to modify to satisfy CMS is how rates are set. Again, right now, counties have a wide leeway to determine what they're going to pay a provider for a specific service. And from the federal perspective, that variation across the state is unacceptable. So we have committed to developing a rate methodology for each service that then provides some flexibility, but not the wide variation that currently exists statewide. Each service, though, may be evaluated and produce a different result. Let me be a little more clear. There are some services that the rate should be the rate and doesn't require, or the evaluation doesn't determine that variability around the state is important. There are some services that may in fact be more expensive or less expensive depending upon where you are in the state. And so there would be a narrow range by which a county could negotiate that component in a provider arrangement for an individual. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, but we do need to evaluate each service component and have a rate methodology that we can explain how we've arrived to it in order to continue our waivers with the federal government.
Thiessen, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. So what's the $2.5 billion or $1 million for? That's the not billion, thankfully. That's administrative cost to develop the rate system? Because it's not phased until 11, right?
We have, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we have a couple components that need to be done with this. Number one, we will be enrolling more providers at a state level. So because that contract management will now take place at a state level, our workload, both in provider enrollment and then managing the contracts, will increase.
What, Mr. Chair, when does that start, though? When are you going to start enrolling at the state level? The only date I see in here is 1/1/11.
Yeah, I believe that would be the implementation, but the prep work to complete that would need to take place prior to that.
Okay, so most of the $2.5 million is actually to develop this new rate structure. It's the administrative cost of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that would be correct.
Okay.
Representative Aber.
Thank you. This is just really interesting. So is this going to leave the burden on the counties by a comparable amount, then? Do you figure an out year from what they've been doing and they'll have lower costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Aber, I guess I'll let the counties speak to that. I think in our judgment it does. It is a substantial amount of work. We can do it somewhat better because, again, if you picture right now, a provider who is doing business in multiple counties has to interact with each of those counties to execute a contract. When we do it, we'll be able to do it once for that provider, and all counties would have access to those contracts. So we're actually finding efficiencies by us doing it at the state level. So the trade-off, initially it was kind of let's let those that are closest to the consumers, when waivers were really small, let's let them develop and access the provider network in their location. As the waivers have now grown to thousands of people, we're finding a need for a different solution.
I'm trying to be brief. This is one of those non-optional costs that we're probably going to have to do because it's a CMS requirement to continue being a waiver state, I suppose, and you can answer that after my other question, too. And if this is a required cost for management, couldn't this be considered part of the coordination or something and be folded into some waiver program and get a federal match on it, at least?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, in our view, it's not optional. We've had to commit to CMS that we will make these modifications, or we would lose the federal participation in our waivers. So in our view, it's not optional. Secondly, all of our activity is evaluated for a federal match, and I let the federal match people of the department determine what components are eligible for that. I'm not an expert in that, and I assure you we are always interested in making sure we maximize that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, just one, if I could.
Well,
I just want to request information for later.
Okay.
And that is, if there's other options about implementing this, I mean, the mandate's not optional, but the cost to get to fulfill the mandate may be optional. Did you consider any other ones? And if you did, it would be great just to get that information.
Okay, Mr. Chair, representation. The options don't spring into my head at the moment, but we'll get you an answer.
And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Coleman, I'm really interested in this, that you're this idea of negotiating the rates for providers fall in centrally. And I'm wondering if you've considered doing that for all of our state health care services and not just for the waiver services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there are some services that lend themselves better to state rate setting and some that don't. In the continuing care, the long-term care area, we're trying to get to better definitions of rate setting via mechanisms like this. We've been trying to standardize rates across our programs, across our waivers, the various disability waivers and so forth. And this will help us document where differences in rates are important via population or via geographic distribution. I'm not going to address, I'm going to beg off on the question of all of our healthcare programs because that's managed by a different part of the agency and I'm not familiar with how they set rates.
Go ahead.
Okay, page.
We've had a follow-up.
Sorry.
Representative Lee.
Sorry about that. Well, Commissioner, maybe that's true for all services, and I don't really, as we sit here, have a clear idea of which ones you're talking about, but there are others under the authority of your department, right, that you could think about doing that with. And actually, your explanation just now is an interesting one because we do need to get a better handle on where variation in rates really means something and where it really doesn't. I mean, we have this discussion all the time talking about nursing home rates and, the geographic variation, which actually, to me, coming from Olmsted County, seems sometimes to be really meaningless. But what about the other services that are under your department? I mean, is that going to be kind of part of the ongoing thinking about how to make changes here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's kind of to my point. We've had a state rate-setting mechanism with nursing facilities for many, many years in accordance with the methodologies that have been legislated, and it, even though we have a state set rate, it hasn't led to greater satisfaction or greater understanding. On the home and community-based side, we've primarily relied upon maximums and then allowed counties, as we've discussed here, to negotiate up to that maximum. Some have negotiated more aggressively than others, let's put it that way. Some may be subject to market conditions. The availability of providers in their communities may be greater than in other parts of the state. We do want to narrow that band, but not restrict access because we've been too prescriptive on what the rate ought to be. But this is movement towards what you are expressing an interest in, yes.
Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dovetailing on the previous dialogue here, your answers give me the impression that you're making the argument in reverse. You're making the argument for a decentralized system, but in fact you're centralizing the system and asking for a major policy change. And last, the other day, you made the comment that the system is, you used the term state-directed, county-administered. I prefer to use the term state-supervised. And wouldn't it have been better now, in retrospect, rather than go through this, to in fact supervise and direct the counties in such a way that rate setting could reflect community differences, geographical differences, availability of providers, philosophies with regard to how we pay people to do this work?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the state has a different perspective than each individual county. And I think what CMS is telling us and what we are agreeing with is that we do have to have a better explanation, a better methodology to make sure that the consumers are being able to access a program regardless of where they're living, and that by allowing counties to be the determinant of rates and contracts, that is not sufficient for CMS. We want to preserve counties' flexibility to use providers. So we're not saying you can only use X number of providers. We're saying we will have a log of enrolled providers by which you can select that will best meet the consumers in your geographic area, your county area. And then to the extent that you want to put together a package. Again, remember, most of these services are kind of a la carte in the waivers that are based upon the individual's needs. And you have to package them in such a way that they meet the person's needs and they are workable within the budget allocation. So I think we're really trying to get the best of both worlds by assuming some responsibility for the framework, but still allowing some flexibility so that counties can focus on the needs of the individuals.
Okay, you could try to wrap up this particular section, then we'll go to the MSOP.
Okay, I'm done with federal compliance. Do you want me to go into the disability waivers?
No. What?
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner Coleman. We're now going to hear about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which is in the Department of Human Services. Dennis Benson is the head of that program, and he will discuss it. Plus, he will also tell us, Representative Solberg was down here, and you all have a copy of House File 117, which is a deficiency bill, which means we have to pass this, or something has to be done to take care of these deficiencies, and there is a major deficiency in Mr. Benson's program, and so he will address this. This will be heard in the finance, the overall finance committee on Monday. So, Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program at both Moose Lake and St. Peter. With me today is Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director. We're going to talk about, as Mr. Chair mentioned, both the deficiency request and our budget request for the 10-11 biennium. We've got a few slides here, just four or five, to give you some backdrop and context of the MSOP program. MSOP, again, being Minnesota Sex Offender Program, for those that, of you that aren't familiar.
If I could interrupt just for a second, you've all received a copy of these slides, I don't know, yesterday or the day before, so they should be in your packet someplace.
Okay. We have two sites, our St. Peter site and the Moose Lake Hospital. Also at Moose Lake, we are currently renting two buildings from the Department of Corrections at the prison. There's both a prison and the psychiatric hospital up at Moose Lake. Because of population growth, we've had to rent beds for the last several years at the prison facility. Basically, in those two sites at the Moose Lake, we have units of 25 that serve the mentally ill young adult unit, high psychopathy unit, behavioral issue unit. Those would be non-treatment compliant folks, and then a 25-bed conventional program, two 25-bed conventional program units. At the Moose Lake prison site, which we refer to as the annex, we have 210-bed wings, and we have both conventional programming over there and then those that are non-compliant. At the Moose Lake prison, we staff a unit of 50 that provide treatment to sex offenders who are still under the jurisdiction of correction, but that might be headed for civil commitment. It's kind of a precursor to civil commitment. They have not yet reached their corrections release date, and the theory there is that hopefully we can start to divert some people from civil commitment by treating them while they're still in corrections. At the St. Peter campus, we have two buildings that are inside of a secure perimeter, Pexton and Chance buildings. There are seven units of 28 to 36 beds. We house the holds, new admissions down there. We have a conventional programming unit, what we call an alternative program, MSOP alternative program. Those would be the lower functioning patients. Assisted living unit, the older folks that need some health care, have the health care issues. And then we have what we call MSOP supervised integration. Those would be individuals that have completed their primary treatment and are getting closer and closer to being considered for reintegration. And then we have a house or a building outside of the secure perimeter that we refer to as the CPS, Building Community Preparation Service. This would be the last step before community placement. Today we have one individual out there. We have another one that has been affirmatively recommended by the Special Review Board. We're awaiting on the Supreme Court Appeal Panel for a final decision. We have a third that will be considered for CPS here, I believe, later this month. So all that in a nutshell, our two sites. This brings us to our deficiency request. About a year ago, I came on board in March, and I believe it was April. We began to discuss the budget issues that were confronting MSOP. And we were told that if we stayed on the trajectory that we were on, we were headed for about a $25 million deficit. We have done a variety of different things since then to bring that down to $16 million, which is in the governor's deficiency request today. Primarily, we've held positions open. We are managing these two sites with 150 fewer staff today than we were a year ago. We've also added about 90 patients today. We've reduced overtime, we've reduced administrative costs, reduced contract costs, one-time costs. And as many of you probably know, a decision was made on the part of DHS and SOS, State Operated Services, about a year ago, to separate MSOP from their budget and also separate them operationally. It really is not a health care program, in my opinion. It's not even close. It is a sex offender treatment program for the high psychopathy, very challenging sex offenders. And like many other states, the decision was to treat it that way, staff it that way, manage it that way. It's not a prison. We're not trying to turn it into a prison, regardless of what you might hear from some of the clientele. But nonetheless, some of the rules are close to what my background is, 34 years with the Department of Corrections. So we have some experience in managing 24/7 operations and trying to create good synergy between security and treatment. We have about 500 sex offender treatment beds, I believe, in corrections, or thereabouts. Might be a little less than that. But we do a lot of chemical dependency treatment over there, too. So that's kind of the mission of MSOP, is to provide sex offender treatment. Today we have about 80% participation. 2-3 years ago they had about 50%. And I think a lot of the increase has to do with separating some of these patients that aren't interested in participating. There were also a couple of high visibility escapes, you might recall, several years ago, and a decision was made to transfer the problematic non-compliant patients from the St. Peter campus up to the Moose Lake campus. And that was at the point that they started renting beds from corrections. They staffed those units up to the point where they felt that they would need to manage this clientele. We have since drawn back some of those staff numbers. We've been able to cut some positions again through attrition, trying to do this responsibly. That have helped with this budget deficit. But the other issue that really has driven the deficit request has been the delay in the new building. As you know, or if you don't, you should know now that we are in the process of building a new 400-bed unit up at the hospital site at Moose Lake. And that was originally, the plan was to have that done last October. It's not done. When I got there in March, they said that, well, it probably won't be done until this October. We've got that ratcheted back till April, but short story long, that required that we had to rent those 200 beds from corrections for another 6, 7, 8, 9 months. That's to the tune of about $660,000 a month. So that's one of the drivers that results in about $5.3 million. In addition to that, when SOS or DHS presented their budget back in 2005, they also believed that they would be out of the business of renting beds from corrections last fall. And the new building, with the new building will come lots of efficiencies in terms of sight lines, staffing levels. And their growth request was reduced by $7.5 million. So those two numbers bring it up to about 12.8, almost $13 million. In addition to that, we have centralized the scheduling, reduced overtime. We have, through attrition, eliminated 150 positions. We've streamlined the administrative structure. We're doing it for about $350,000 less this year than we were a year ago. So we got the number down to $16 million. But, and again, the growth has been phenomenal in this program, something that DHS, MSOP doesn't have control over for the most part. those have been the drivers that have led to the deficiency request.
Mr. Benson, isn't this $60 million that you owe corrections?
Mr. Chair,
money from one department to another.
Mr. Chair, $5.3 million of that. We're short $5.3 million for renting beds. That's certainly a piece of it. In addition to that, the efficiencies did not evolve in a timely manner, so that's the other $7.5 million. We do hope to have this new building online. We're supposed to be, the new completion date is April 30th. It'll take us a month to clean it, debug it, get it ready. We hope to be out of the rent-a-bed business by July 1. So starting the next biennium, we are positioned to be down to a base level that I think is more in keeping with our population number. So in a nutshell, that is the deficiency request. Move into the budget request now. And then I'd just like to ask that you take a peek at page, I believe it's 147 in the budget book, is where you will find our budget information and our budget request. We are asking for about $14 million in growth, 5.67 in fiscal year 10, 8.33 in fiscal year 11. We break that down into three different categories. The projected growth, and by the way, we are projecting every patient that we add to our count, we believe is going to cost about $150 a day. We refer to that as a marginal per diem. That will ultimately bring down the total per diem, and the stated per diem this year, I believe, is $348 a day. So over time, that per diem should come down as we get into more efficient buildings and we continue to put these efficiencies in place. So based on that, and given what we're projecting in terms of growth, and Mr. Storkamp will go over those growth numbers in a moment, the first year for growth we need $1.97 million, second year it's $6.03. It's roughly 70 to 74, 75 new patients every year. That's the rate this program is growing at. If you recall, the last session, our base was cut by $2.3 million a year, our base budget in tails only. And we, as I mentioned, we have held 150 positions open. We think we can hold a few more open, but we're going to reach a point where we can't do it inside of the budget short of that $2.3 million. So that's $4.6 million as part of our budget request. And in the last line item there, you see the $1.4 million. We have been working hard at bringing our staffing numbers down through attrition. And we've done that simply because we're operating right now in inefficient buildings. We believe that once we get to the new buildings, we can manage it with lower staffing levels, but until then, it's going to be challenging. So if we're going to continue by June 30th or July 1, we think we're going to be down to about maybe 30 additional staff. If we lay them off July 1, we would need a piece of that $1.4 million. If we manage it through attrition, which probably isn't a bad way to do it, moving into a new 400-bed building with a population that continues to grow, we would need the $1.4 million in just fiscal year 10 and no dollars in fiscal year 11.
Our
base budget going into next year is 60.25. With the 2.3, it'd be about $62.5 million. That's what we're hoping to start the next fiscal year at. And again, we think that that number is manageable. That will give us a per diem of about $315 a day on July 1. So we're headed in the right direction here in terms of per diem. If you look at this chart, we started a year ago at 368 was the stated per diem. And this year, if we add these new beds in the new budget cycle at $150 a day, we'll start the next biennium at 315. When we get that building full, it should be down to about 285 in today's dollars. Ultimately, when we get the second building full, that per diem should be down around 250. That compares pretty favorably with other programs like this around the country. As you know, these programs are not cheap. Treatment is required. These are civil commits. They're not offenders, so they have rights that offenders don't. That makes this much more expensive. We don't get to lock them in the way you can an offender. Patients have entitlements that are consistent with someone who's under civil commitment as opposed to a criminal commitment. Again, our neighbors to the east, Wisconsin, are at around $281 a day. I would remind you that they're dealing with one site, not three sites. They're much more efficient. You can get most of the patients under one roof. And again, I think our long-range plan here is consistent with the industry standard. We're doing what we can to manage these costs responsibly.
Interrupt. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, a couple questions. First of all, just quickly, for most of the people on the committee, I think, don't sit on public safety. Could you just tell us what the current per diem is just for the regular prison population? Is it about $83 a day as compared to what you're talking about currently for this? I think you said it was about $343.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, that's pretty close. I believe around $85 in corrections. And we're at about $348. That's our stated per diem this year.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, just for the members, there's going to be a joint hearing of this committee next week with the two public safety committees on the population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I wanted, first of all, to let people know, you know, how very different that is. And then you mentioned that that this population has rights that the prison population doesn't have because they're not, in fact, prisoners. They're supposed to be, at least we say they're there for treatment. And I wonder if you could just give us some examples of some of the rights that you said that these rights make it much more expensive to have them in under this kind of confinement than in the regular prison population. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the overriding issue is the notion that they sleep in their room. Beyond that, unless you have just cause to keep them locked up, we don't lock them up. They are patients, very similar to what you see in a treatment program in the community. So that takes certainly more staff. In corrections, they're treating about 17-18% of the sex offenders. So their treatment costs are dramatically, dramatically lower than ours. We are, by statute and design of the program, required to treat anybody who's willing to participate in treatment. So our treatment participation is up around 80%. So we have a very rich clinical team, which is also not cheap. Those would be a couple. Their right to practice their religion, their diet, their room allowable items is very different from what I was used to in corrections. Again, unless you have compelling rationale why you aren't going to let them have something in their room, it becomes challenging not to let them have it. Courts are all over this program. We get there's lots of litigation with this population. again, because of their constitutional rights around the fact that they're a patient, they are not under criminal commitment. Certainly the fact that we have them in a secure environment, I don't think that I'm overstating the facts when probably next to the collapse of the bridge, I don't know that there has been a public safety hysteria, at least in the St. Peter community, like there was when we had the escapes down there, when MSOP experienced the escapes several years ago. So there is concern about this population, and that also gives rise to appropriate and adequate security. The perimeter systems are not just single fences. They're very similar to what we have in corrections. There are some of these folks who are never going home. There are many of them that are aging out, that are going to die in this program, and we all know that healthcare costs the last 7% of your years is probably 80% of what you spend over a lifetime on healthcare. So those numbers are all significant, significant drivers for this population. I'd add that we haven't released anybody in 12 years. We do have one person at the community preparation program. The difference between our program and one that is probably well respected, the Wisconsin program, they release about 5 a year. So the difference between Roaring Success and a program that's getting its legs under it is about 5 a year. So I don't know that we're ever going to see massive numbers coming out of this program. It's courts in, courts out. We are the repository here. But I can also tell you that if we don't manage this program properly, it will come under the control of the federal court, which occurred in Washington, and then you have some outcomes that are less than desirable too in terms of accommodating a civilly committed population.
So we have three more people I have questions, so Representative Liebling, you can go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I didn't mean to get you into the whole issue, which I know we're going to talk about again, but I just was, you know, the $265 difference between the per diems, you know, every day the difference is $265, and I just wanted to maybe ask you to think about that for the next hearing to explain a little bit better why that difference in cost, because I understand what you just said about cost drivers and so on, but it's the difference that I think, you know, would be interesting to learn a little bit more about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please don't be offended by my question, but one plausible conclusion is the difference between 348 and 83 equals treatment. Yet, you've acknowledged you have not had one treatment success in 12 years. Talk to me about that.
Mr. Chair. Representative, that's a fair question, and certainly a concern that I think we all share. I would, at the risk of sounding defensive, I've been here for 10 months. My experience is corrections. There have been, I think, several different barriers in terms of people getting through this program. Number one, I think we've had 4 clinical directors in 5 years. There has been unprecedented growth with this population. This is not unusual. It's not unique to Minnesota. Washington, the state that I just mentioned, I don't think has released anyone in recent history either. It's a very, very difficult recalcitrant population. These are out of the 16, 17,000 registered sex offenders. These are the 400 or 500 that kind of fall through all the sifters and end up in this program. I am confident, however, that moving forward, we will see some people that began to complete treatment, and again, it is a decision of the court who comes in and also who goes out. The other piece that I missed, Representative, with respect to cost, is there are about 503 people in our 3 different locations, Corrections has 10,000. So you get that economy of scale. They're feeding those people on $3.29 a day. We're feeding at the St. Peter campus because it's more of a health care menu. We're feeding them on about $10 a day for three meals. So, you know, corrections budget is also $500 million a year, minus $62 million. So while the daily cost might seem high, the total cost for this program is obviously much lower. I think we can do better, and we will do better. We've got a clinical team now that has about a 70, 80, almost 90 years of clinical experience. That's new for this program. They have run this program historically with very qualified people in the healthcare field, but we have three good clinical directors now, one at each site, a program director at the Moose Lake facility site that is president of APSA. My clinical director, Janine Hebert, who's here today, has about 20 years of sex offender treatment experience, and she's president of the Minnesota chapter. So I think we've got some people that understand what best practices are. We have worked closely with Wisconsin. I think we're going to bring a treatment protocol that those who really want to work hard at treatment may in the future find that they're going to have much more success in terms of trying to get to the next step, which would be community preparation and ultimately a provisional discharge into the community. But again, my responsibility is public safety, providing the best treatment that we can, and it is up to the courts to determine when they're ready. We will tell them when we believe that the risk has been reduced. Obviously, there are never going to be any guarantees, but we know more about treating this population today than we did even 5 years ago. So we're making some progress and headway.
Mr. Benson, if you could wrap up the budget presentation.
We will do that.
We're a minute over.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We just got two slides left, and I'm going to defer to Mr. Sparkamp here, who's going to talk to you a little bit about the numbers that drive this budget.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Sparkamp, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I, too, joined the team here just less than 10 months ago. I will be very brief, knowing the time frame here. Our population for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program has grown dramatically. Since 2003 tragic incident, we have had tremendous growth in the program. That growth, moving forward into the future, is looking between 70 and 80 a year increase. And this really is the bulk of the request for growth in funding, $2 and $6 million respectively. On the next chart, what we've done is we put the projections on the line as showing that they're continually increased. We also put bars on here showing you where they currently have patients as well as where we're going to be anticipating putting our sex offender patients. The black bar on the bottom is our base. That is the main building at Moose Lake as well as our beds at St. Peter. The white bar is the annex that we're currently renting, and Dennis Benson mentioned here recently, that actually cost us significantly because we're paying Department of Corrections, plus we're also paying for our staff to be there. We're actually paying twice for that program. When the building opens up, we have the new 400-bed building we talked about here, phase one, opens in July of this year. That building is between 55 and 60% full because we're pulling everybody from the annex over into the new building. And by the end of 2011, we will be out of space again under the current projections, which were forecast back in November. Then we're talking about the possibility of another phase two building, another 400 beds with the ancillary services, which have been discussed here at the legislature previously.
Okay, any questions? We can discuss this further next week when we meet with the Public Safety Committee. So, Mr. Benson, you had something to add.
Mr. Chair, I neglected on the bottom of this slide, I neglected to mention the early retirement change, the corrections early retirement, which also impacts our security staff. That would save $578,000 the first year and $666,000 second year. This was a Department of Corrections initiative that's in the governor's budget that impacts MSOP as well as state-operated services. Basically, what it does, takes people out of early retirement unless you're in uniform. So that's the crux of that line item.
And that, members, is fairly controversial in itself, that little item. So with that, I would adjourn the meeting.